This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Monday, Sri Lanka's civil war finished a decade ago. So why are many of its citizens still trying to get to Australia by boat?
There hasn't necessarily been an increase in any sort of anti-Tamil or anti-Hindu sentiment. However, there is a presidential election, and so this is causing a lot of concern.
And liver disease and even death. Health experts call for restrictions on over-the-counter paracetamol tablets in response to a spike in overdoses. But first to Melbourne, where there'll be another court hearing today into the Sri Lankan Tamil family trying to avoid deportation as federal officials detain the family on Christmas Island. The Home Affairs Minister is continuing to resist appeals for him to use his discretion to let the family stay in Australia and return to their home in rural Queensland. Now a former senior Immigration Department official is adding his voice to those calls, as Samantha Donovan reports.
Speaking in Sydney this morning, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was showing no sign of yielding to public pressure.
We have a process in this country. Under our border protection regime, if people have illegally entered Australia, as they did under the previous government, they had their claims assessed. In this case, their claims were found to be invalid. They were never told that they could settle in Australia. They were aware of that the entire time. And while I understand the deep human issues around this, you've got to think about the implications for this. It went through every court to our highest court in the land. And every single one of those courts upheld the decisions that were taken. Now, at a time when there are increasing push factors coming out of Sri Lanka, the worst possible thing you could do was to send a decision, send a message which said, you know what? If you come illegally to Australia and the courts say you don't have a claim and the government say you don't have a claim, then the government just might make an exception because there's been a public reaction.
The Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, was on breakfast television this morning putting the same case.
They've been to every court, right up to the High Court. They've been told that they're not refugees. Now, I understand the compassion shown by many, but we have to look at this case on its merit. There's no indication at all that's been given to this family, including before they had children, that they would ever settle in this country.
Speaking on Channel 9, Mr. Dutton dismissed concerns about the family being moved from Melbourne to Christmas Island late at night as the spurious comments of lawyers and advocates.
They're not in detention up there, and they have the ability to fly directly from there to Sri Lanka without the protesters barricading themselves in a position where we can't get cars past. It provided for a very dangerous situation potentially in Melbourne, and we're not going to tolerate that. We're not going to put our officers at risk.
But Mr. Dutton's coalition colleague, Barnaby Joyce, is again arguing for the family to stay. He told Channel 7 theirs is a special case.
This couple met in Australia. The children were born in Australia. You know, the community accepts them in Australia. They're doing jobs that other people don't want to do. They're living in a regional town. They're not blocking up your traffic in Sydney, Melbourne or Brisbane. They haven't just gone and lived down in one of the suburbs and, you know, and not really made an effort to become part of the community. I hate at times going at odds with Peter Dutton, who's a great minister, but I think this one's a special circumstance and I've got to look after the regional.
Abul Rizvi is a former Deputy Secretary of the Immigration Department. He wants the Immigration Minister, David Coleman, to use his discretion to let the family stay.
If you look at the guidelines for ministerial intervention, this case very much meets those guidelines. Whereas, for example, if you were to look at the case of the two au pairs in which Mr. Dutton did intervene, I would argue those cases did not meet the guidelines.
Why do you think it is in the national interest for the Tamil family to stay in Australia?
Predominantly because an overriding objective of government's policy at the moment on immigration is to encourage more young people, young workers, to settle in regional Australia. These people have committed to stay there. The community wants them there.
But if the minister were to intervene, would that send a message to the people smugglers that they can tell potential clients that they may in fact be able to travel to Australia by boat and eventually be allowed to stay in the country?
To be frank, the people smuggler signalling argument is a furphy. The Howard government resettled hundreds and hundreds of boat arrivals in Australia, giving them permanent residence without creating these so-called signals.
But were those people found to have been genuine refugees?
Yes, they mostly were.
But not this family, though.
No, not this family. This family has not been found to be genuine refugees. But the argument here is not genuine refugee. The argument here is ministerial discretion on national interest grounds.
Abul Rizvi is a former Deputy Secretary of the Immigration Department. Samantha Donovan reporting. Well, as he faces pressure to use his ministerial discretion, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton has chosen this moment to reveal details of Border Force operations that the government generally keeps secret. Today, Mr. Dutton disclosed that security forces have intercepted 6 boatloads of asylum seekers from Sri Lanka this year. He claims they're not legitimate refugees, but are economic migrants seeking a better life. Isabel Rowe has been investigating what is driving people from Sri Lanka to head here by boat.
After a weekend of protests about the federal government's handling of the Sri Lankan Tamil family's refugee claim, Minister Peter Dutton has written a newspaper opinion piece claiming there's been an influx of economic refugees from the country, the latest just last month.
13 people were on this boat, and it is a very significant concern because there is a lot of activity up in Sri Lanka at the moment, and it's our biggest concern in the region, and we'll continue to make sure that we can stop the boats.
Asked on Channel 9 about the timing of his decision to reveal information about boats from Sri Lanka, the minister denied any political motivation.
No, we've provided a lot of detail since I've been minister at different points about, and I think we've publicly made available information in relation to every venture.
Minister Dutton says Border Force officials intercepted each boat before it arrived. He claims they are economic refugees, people seeking a better life and aren't being persecuted for their religion or race. Charles Sturt University economist and Sri Lankan commentator Dr. Yappa Bandara agrees.
Do not give in to the unhuman, barbaric people smuggling act.
So people who are coming on boats, are they being persecuted in Sri Lanka?
No. They are coming under the people smugglers' trail.
About 6,000 Tamils fled persecution in 2012 to Australia after the end of the Civil War. But Dr. Bandara suggests these Sri Lankans coming by boat in more recent years are not just Tamils, but also Sinhalese and Muslims. He believes many of those people fit the economic refugee tag, but not everyone agrees.
Yeah, it certainly could be true, and it certainly could be true that they are legitimate asylum seekers.
Dr. Michael Breen is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne School of Social and Political Science. He says an assumption that all Sri Lankan boat arrivals are economic refugees is wrong.
There are continuing reports of Tamils who have links or past links to the LTTE being persecuted, even being abducted. There's certainly a lot of religious tension in Sri Lanka still, but most of the tension is directed towards Muslims following the terrorist attacks earlier this year.
And he thinks unease in Sri Lanka, particularly for Tamils, will only increase. The Sri Lankan opposition candidate for December's presidential election is former Defence Chief Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who led the persecution of Tamils during the war.
So this has increased concern amongst many Tamils on the island about what would happen if Rajapaksa is successful in those presidential elections.
In his opinion piece, Peter Dutton writes he won't take a moral lecture on the issue of asylum seekers coming by boat. But Tamil Refugee Council spokesman Aaron Mulwaganam says more compassion is what's required.
The Sri Lankan government is trying to suffocate the Tamil nation. And there are genuine reasons why Tamils have to flee Sri Lanka. It is not for economic reasons. People don't leave Sri Lanka because they want to come and have a good time in Australia. When people leave, they have to leave so many of their family members behind, and they don't do it for economic reasons.
Tamil Refugee Council spokesman Aaron Mulwaganam, ending Isabel Rowe's report. Shopping bags full of money, claims of foreign influence and the downfall of a Labor Party executive. The New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption has heard some sensational and disturbing revelations in its recent hearings. And evidence that the New South Wales Labor Party received a $100,000 donation from a now-banned Chinese property developer has refocused calls for a national anti-corruption watchdog with the power to keep an eye on federal politicians. Geoffrey Watson SC is a Sydney barrister, a director of the Centre for Public Integrity, and a former counsel assisting the New South Wales Corruption Commission. Geoffrey Watson, welcome to The World Today.
Well, it's great to be here.
Right now, there is no Federal Anti-Corruption Commission. Could conduct of the kind now being investigated in the New South Wales Commission be similarly scrutinised if it were alleged to be happening in national politics?
No, it couldn't. That's the big problem. There is no federal agency equipped to carry out such an inquiry.
In New South Wales, it was the Electoral Commission which discovered these Labor Party donation discrepancies and referred the matter to the New South Wales Corruption Commission. Would the Electoral Commission not be capable of exposing any similar concerns at the federal level?
I'm sorry to say, the Federal Electoral Commission, which does a wonderful job in organising elections, is given no teeth whatsoever to try and find this kind of conduct, much less expose it. Even in New South Wales, our Electoral Commission, which uncovered the conduct, referred it on to ICAC, which does have the teeth to bite and get these things out into the open.
Prior to the federal election, the Morrison government did put forward a model for a federal anti-corruption body. How do its powers compare to the New South Wales Anti-Corruption Commission, the ICAC that you've just mentioned?
So awful. I say this seriously. Their proposal would be worse than having no commission at all because it's such a sham. Corrupt people, corrupt public officials and politicians could wave around and say, see, there's been no investigation by the federal ICAC. How does it compare? For starters, there was an embargo on investigating anything which had happened in the past. Second thing is, to initiate any kind of investigation requires it to be shown that the criminal offences occurred. Well, that's just absurd. That's too high a threshold. And by that stage, if criminal offence is already discovered, then it's a matter for the police. Also, nothing can be done publicly. It's all to be done secretively. Just think about it now, if that wonderful Royal Commission into Institutional Child Abuse, just imagine for a moment if that had been able to be kept secret by the same institutions who are under investigation. I could go on, but my favourite is this. There is an embargo under the coalition model at looking into the affairs of politicians. They're going to protect themselves. It's a sham.
You say that, oh, well, if there were criminal conduct, it would be investigated by the police. Why is a police investigation not adequate?
It's been found over years that the police are not geared up to investigate these kinds of crimes. What it is with public sector corruption, incidentally, the most serious crime in the world today. With public sector corruption, what you've got is those who make up the rules are those who are finding the loopholes in them so as to take advantage of them. The thing is that it's almost impossible to uncover that kind of thing if you do not have exemplary powers, kinds of powers customarily given to a royal commissioner, the power to secure the attendance of somebody to question them. That's how not only ICAC in New South Wales, but the other major anti-corruption agencies around Australia work. And the thing is that the police do not. Meanwhile, we have absurd comments. For example, Mr. Abbott said, while he was the leader, he said that there was no federal corruption. Of course there's federal corruption. There isn't something magic about the border with Canberra.
In the wake of these recent revelations from the New South Wales inquiry, the Labor Party federally is now calling for a much stronger federal anti-corruption body than the government is putting forward. But federal Labor leader Anthony Albanese previously expressed concerns that in some forms a corruption body could inhibit government. What do you say to that?
It should inhibit government. It should inhibit corrupt government. And the thing is that it won't interfere with good government. But I think these events at ICAC will turn them around and they will come on board and support a strong ICAC. I think it'll be positive. I think that what we'll get is a toothless tiger under the coalition. But one day we'll get this, Eleanor. 80% of Australians support it.
Geoffrey Watson, thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
And Geoffrey Watson is a Sydney barrister and former counsel assisting the Independent Commission Against Corruption in New South Wales. This is The World Today. The biggest cause of liver failure in the Western world is not alcohol, it's paracetamol. The popular pain relief drug can be deadly if taken in excessive quantities. A new Australian research reveals that overdosing from paracetamol has increased by nearly 45% over the last decade. The study authors are calling for limits on the size of a packet to help reduce the overdose rate, as Julia Holman reports.
It's one of the most popular drugs for pain relief, but taking too much paracetamol can be dangerous. Like, I work at the Poison Centre and it is our number one call, and that has been for a couple of decades now.
Dr Rose Cairns is a Director of Research at the New South Wales Poison Centre and lecturer in pharmacy at the University of Sydney. She says paracetamol is the drug Australians most frequently overdose on.
I think it's just because it's so widely available. Everyone has it in their cupboard and you can get it anywhere outside of pharmacies, so that's why it's the number one thing that we get called about.
Dr Cairns has written a study released today in the Medical Journal of Australia, which shows that paracetamol overdose has increased by 44% over the past decade. In the financial year to 2008, 8,000 people were admitted to hospital with paracetamol poisoning. But in 2016-17, the figures show nearly 12,000 people went to hospital after overdosing.
We were really surprised to find that. Obviously, that's a very concerning increase, 44% in a decade. What we were even more concerned about was the increase in liver injury, which was increasing at an even faster rate. So that's doubled in the same time.
Paracetamol itself is not toxic, but in large amounts, the body can't process it. Dr Cairns says in severe cases, someone who suffered an overdose can need a liver transplant or die.
So unfortunately, we saw over 200 deaths in the same period. So
in a decade?
Yeah, in a decade, yeah.
Are these overdoses that you're seeing, are they intentional or unintentional?
Yeah, so look, our national data set looked at all poisoning types and about 75% of those were intentional poisonings.
What have some countries done to try to reduce the rate of paracetamol overdose?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because paracetamol availability differs quite widely country to country. So a really good example is the UK. So 20 years ago now, they were seeing pretty high rates of deaths from paracetamol. So they reduced the pack sizes available. So they reduced it to 32 tablets in pharmacies and 16 outside of pharmacies. And what they saw is a long-term reduction in overdose size, liver injury, and deaths from paracetamol. And it's not just the UK. A lot of European countries have pretty strict rules about paracetamol as well. You know, for example, Denmark, you can't buy it unless you're 18. And a lot of them restrict it to pharmacy-only sales and pretty small packs as well.
Currently in Australia, you can buy packs of 100 paracetamol tablets in pharmacies, and it's available in supermarkets or convenience stores in packs of 20. The Victorian president of the Pharmacy Guild of Australia is Anthony Tassoni. He says the Guild is open to restricting access to 100 packs of paracetamol.
We do have the opportunity with our Australian scheduling system that if it's thought that there needs to be additional safeguards for maintaining packs of 100 over the counter without a prescription, we can reclassify that as Schedule 3, being pharmacist-only medicine, meaning the pharmacist needs to personally have oversight of each and every sale or provision of that to a patient or consumer.
And the Pharmacy Guild's Anthony Tassoni argues there should be more oversight on the amount of paracetamol you can buy in a supermarket or convenience store.
People can actually purchase multiple packets from a supermarket or convenience store without question because there's no professional oversight.
The Therapeutic Goods Administration governs drug sales in Australia. It's recently restricted the availability of higher strength paracetamol to behind the counter. The World Today contacted the TGA for comment.
Julia Holman reporting. And if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 131114. Last summer, fires burned out 95,000 hectares of Tasmania's Wilderness World Heritage Area. And fire experts are warning that this summer could see similar destruction that could see these World Heritage Areas lost forever, as Rebecca Hewitt reports.
Sparked by thousands of dry lightning strikes, fuelled by dry vegetation and fanned by strong winds, Tasmania's Wilderness World Heritage Area burned for months last summer, with 32 fires devastating large swathes of the pristine forests. More than 2,000 hectares of threatened native vegetation was damaged, and several popular bushwalks are still closed. And the forecasts are for a hot and dry spring and summer. David Bowman, a professor of pyrogeography at the University of Tasmania, says this poses a real threat to the area's King Billy, Huon and Pencil pines.
The worst outlook is that they're going to be severely damaged and most likely will never recover because of climate change.
One of the challenges particular to that environment is when fire gets into the soil in those areas, it can be near impossible to extinguish.
Most of the soil in the World Heritage Area is actually organic soil, and if you dry it out, it will burn really like brown coal, and it kills the vegetation because it kills the roots, and it can burn, you know, deeply into the soil, not necessarily down to bedrock, but it can have a very major impact.
A review into last season's firefighting efforts by the Australasian Fire and Emergency Service Authorities Council praised the state's firefighters on the length they went to protect key wilderness assets, like installing a sprinkler system to safeguard vegetation around Lake Rona in the Wild Rivers National Park and wrapping some historically significant huts in fireproof material. But it said rather than responding in the heat of an emergency, strategies need to be determined in advance. It also recommended a volunteer remote area firefighting force be set up to be dropped in by helicopter and tackle outbreaks on the ground. Money has been allocated in the state budget, but trained crews are unlikely to be ready this season. David Bowman says there's an uneasiness with allocating a unique budget to wilderness areas when homes might also be at risk.
I think that there's a real tension in the state between trying to find the balance between managing the World Heritage Area as a priority and protecting life and property outside the World Heritage Area, forest areas, plantations, farmland, and obviously places like Hobart could be at risk.
A meeting is being held on Wednesday between fire authorities and experts to discuss the specifics of the season ahead.
Rebecca Hewitt in Hobart. Later this week, official economic growth figures are tipped to show that Australia's economy is growing at the slowest pace since the global financial crisis. So is it time to start preparing for a recession? The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is with me now in the studio. Peter, what are the most worrying signs about the health of the Australian economy?
Eleanor, there are some pretty big uncertainties at the moment. US-China trade tensions, which could explode into a fully blown trade war, protests in Hong Kong, of course, Brexit in the background, and rising tensions between the US and Iran. That's the global backdrop, but domestically, construction and investment are weakening. The retail sector in particular, department stores, are in recession. That's at least according to the owner of David Jones. The Reserve Bank Board meets tomorrow. No rate cut is expected, but they've already slashed to 1%, mainly to get the jobless rate down to 4.5%. But inflation is still very low, and the Reserve Bank is running out of options to get inflation higher and to, of course, stimulate the economy.
So should Australians be bracing for a recession?
Well, it's starting to head that way, Eleanor. Wednesday's official GDP figures will be soft, just 0.5% in the most recent quarter, 1.4% over the year. But the economy is still growing. And of course, you need two consecutive quarters of negative growth for a technical recession. And we haven't even had one yet. But Dr. Timo Henkel, chairman of the Reserve Bank's shadow board at the ANU, says the economy is heading in that direction and that after 28 years, some softening up might be required for many workers who have no life experience of a recession.
It does. That's what I think most analysts expect, whether we will have a formal recession defined as two consecutive quarters of negative growth is, of course, something we'll have to see. But what's interesting, I think, is that this may be uncharted territory, given that the last recession is so long ago. And many people in the economy, many mortgagees, even the younger generation of politicians will just not have had any experience of dealing with a recession. That, to me, is, I think, one of the interesting questions is how that will play out, both economically and politically, and what kind of policies governments will adopt.
Of course, many of today's workers have never experienced a recession, and some weren't even born.
Correct. When I, in my introductory macro classes at ANU, talk about business cycles and recessions, I get some flustered looks on the faces of the young kids who clearly have no idea of what a recession is and often think I'm just talking about economic history from a long time ago, well before their time. But I think we have to realize that the business cycle is never dead. We've had an extraordinary run, 28 years of expansion, but that does not mean that we cannot experience a serious economic slowdown or recession. And there's a buildup of fragilities in our economy. We don't have that much living experience amongst a whole generation of what that means and what that entails.
The last recession was obviously very tough for many people, but in today's world of social media, Facebook and Instagram, surely that hardship would be amplified.
Could well be. Again, I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, given that we don't have much experience of that with the young generation. Of course, there are plenty of foreigners who live in Australia who may have had experience with recessions, and the older generation certainly does. I, on a regular basis, deal with people for whom the recession we had to have in the early 90s is still very vivid in their memories.
That's Dr. Timo Henkel, Chairman of the Reserve Bank Shadow Board at the Australian National University, with the ABC's Peter Ryan. And that's all from World Today team for this Monday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's Daily News and Current Affairs podcast, The Signal.
Today's episode is about the case of a climate change protester in Queensland who's arguing her actions were a reasonable response to the climate change emergency. It's a legal tactic that's worked for activists overseas, but never here.
So could that be about to change? And what happens if judges start deciding that climate change is a good enough excuse to break the law?
That's The Signal every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you normally hear your podcasts.